I'm opening. We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, movie lovers, to another dissection here at Anatomy of a Movie. Today's dissection, a Korean film called Snowpiercer, although 80%, I would even say 90% of it is in English.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Which was, I'm not going to complain, but I also don't mind reading subtitles.
If you were lucky enough to get subtitles in your viewing of this movie.
I don't.
Which not everyone got.
We're going to talk about that because that is baffling to me. That is the sound of Sarah Stratton.
Oh, hi guys.
I am Phil Svitek. We have a little bit of short panel today, but over in the booth we have the one, the only Stephen Lemieux, who saw it without subtitles.
Hey guys, yeah. I only had body language to go on.
Hooray!
But the ironic part was, he actually, for the most part, understood it. So it's going to be interesting to get his take on it. And whatever else. So we've got quite a diverse panel. Obviously, we'll talk about the whole theatrical release versus video on demand. Sarah represents the theatrical release side. I represent the video on demand side. And Steven represents the no subtitle side.
Hooray.
There you go.
Overall impressions.
I have to preface this with I am biased and I have a complex relationship with this movie. Because first off, when I saw it originally, like the first time I saw it, there was a couple of things that bothered me, but overall, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I'm also going to point out that I work in one of the 8 theaters that released this film in the U.S., one of the first 8. And it was the busiest weekend we've had, like, literally all year. It brought in the most people. We had sold out shows every night. And we weren't expecting it because there hadn't been a ton of advertising for Snowpiercer, so we just thought it was going to be just a regular, small, indie film. And we got slammed. So underneath my opinion of loving this movie, there was also, like, a slight resentment because it cost me to, like, not have any sleep and to run around for an entire weekend. On top of that, this is one of our latest showing movies, and it lasts the longest. So I've watched the ending of this movie about, I don't know, too many times to count. And the ending is one of the parts I don't like the most. So it's literally like watching your least favorite scene, like, over and over again. So that's kind of what has stuck with me. But overall, I have a lot of positive things to say. So I just wanted to, I need to make that stance clear that there's so many things I love about this movie, about the story behind it, how it was shot, what it looks like, the acting, so many good things. But sometimes I have this little, like,
love-hate relationship.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's more because of, like, a personal basis of how, like, it has become involved in my life. So I needed to just get that out there.
Well, this is a good decompression session for you. Steven, your overall thoughts of the movie?
I really liked it. I thought it was kind of a nice surprise to the summer, like, beginning of summer, because I didn't know it was coming out. And then I saw it, and I was like, hey, that looks exciting. And then I go and see it, and I'm like, wow, I really enjoyed this movie. Because, you know, it takes a lot to create a world that you can actually dive into. And even if it has its plot points that are maybe a little cliche, and like the ending that maybe doesn't agree with some people, like, I was kind of iffy on the ending, but I get what they were going for. Watching the movie itself, you can dive into this world, you can understand kind of what it is for what it is, and it's kind of a trip. It's a cool trip, and it's a great summer movie to check out and, you know, just enjoy instead of, like, trying to break it really. I mean, that's what we're here to do, but I'm talking about, like, if you want to bring your kids to, not your kids, but you know what I mean.
I don't think you'd bring your kids to this. I had people asking for refunds because it was too violent for them, so.
It was very violent.
I'm not sure if it's a kid-friendly movie.
Yeah, Steve's got a different impression of how he's going to raise his children. I agree. I really like this movie. For those of you first-time listeners, you can imagine we're going to talk a lot about spoilers, so if you have not seen this movie, please stop now, go see the movie, then check back in.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get some comments about that, but yes, we are very spoiler-filled.
That is what we are. We are spoilers, completely.
I like this movie because it's a great allegory, you know, kind of, in much in the way that Animal House perhaps is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it has its flaws kind of throughout, but, you know, it can all be overcome by what it's trying to accomplish. You know, and ultimately, you know, we'll talk about why it ended up being so select versus, you know, a wide release, and part of it's the violence, part of it's the allegories. But I think the people that have flocked to it, they are really enjoying it, both in action and the ideas.
I agree. I think that one of the strongest points of this movie is the fact that it has created such a buzz within itself versus using like the main, like, you know, blockbuster type in your face advertisements. This has really, to me, been spread by the fans, and, you know, they're doing the video on demand release and everything like that. But in general, I would say 90% of the people who have walked out of this movie, I'm hearing great things from. And that's not just from, like, I think a lot of people expected this to be, like, a critic-pleasing movie. It was coming out with really high scores, and people are like, oh, it's so artsy and deep and whatever. But I think it really bridges the gap between what a blockbuster movie is and what a really smart movie is. And they kind of meshed those two together. And that I do think it has kind of like a blockbuster appeal. It's very, you know, great shots, and it's everything's, there's like these really epic scenes, and it's fast and action packed, obviously. But then there's also so much going on underneath, and the heart of the story does have a lot of symbolism, does have a lot of other meanings. And I think those things add together to make a really great product.
So, you know, in terms of how this came to be, I think it's an interesting story. The director, and I'm not even going to try to say his name.
You have to try, or we can make Steven try.
Joon-ho Bong.
What?
It's Joon-ho Bong.
Joon-ho Bong.
Then why on the poster does it say Bong Joon-ho?
Because they
put the last, it's an honorific, like you can put the first name first, the last name first. It's
different.
Okay. There we go. Because it confuses me sometimes.
Well, regardless, when he was at the time of The Host,
mm-hmm.
he went to a comic book store that he liked, and he came across this French comic book / graphic novel, and he really felt...
You can pronounce that one, too.
No.
Steven?
Are you French? Your last name's French, Lemieux. You better be able to pronounce this.
And he goes silent.
He goes, yeah.
Le train serpentage? I don't know. I can't.
You're French. Last name's
it's
French.
It's just, it's like the train piercer is basically mm-hmm. what it's saying.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, he fell in love with this and, you know, really kind of wanted to make it. He consulted with a lot of his friends, mm-hmm. you know, in the director community, and they fell in love with it too. And I believe in, you know, late 2006, they finally were able to secure the rights to a screen adaptation mm-hmm. of this. And that's kind of, you know, long and short of it. Eventually things kind of came together and, you know, we start shooting at around 2012.
And definitely the graphic novel was a source of inspiration, and that's where the main plot line comes from for the movie. But he did add his own elements to it. From what I understand, I have not read the graphic novel, but from what I understand, the whole climate change fiasco was not a part of the graphic novel. So he added all of that mm-hmm. Kind of as another, you know, sub-storyline and setup. And I think those are interesting choices. And, I mean, maybe that's bringing this graphic novel into more of what he felt like were current issues. I'm not sure if I completely am on board for that choice or not.
I'm on board for that choice because it just, you know, in terms of making it wide scale, it gave it just the reason, just enough
mm-hmm.
to get behind it and move forward from there. And in terms of, it's his own stamp, and I think, you mm-hmm. know, one of the biggest arguments that we'll certainly talk about later is kind of his stamp versus what other people wanted him to mm-hmm. do. And, you know, for the most part, it is the movie that he wanted to put out there for better or worse. We'll talk about, you know, them wanting to cut 20 minutes out of the movie.
Yes, he very much stuck to his artistic guns for this film,
which was violence, allegory, and snow.
Everyone needs a little bit of snow. It makes it very pretty. I'll give it that. It makes the scope at certain shots just jaw-dropping.
I mean, in terms of, you know, to me, there's not, apart from kind of that journey, there's not much else in terms of what I read about the pre-production. But in terms of the production, mm-hmm. I love it because they wanted to build four trains in a row. Obviously, that they would eventually switch out as they got further and further.
Are you talking about how they searched for studio space?
Yes.
And how they specifically wanted studios that would be long enough to accommodate these four trains in a row instead Correct. Of separating them all?
Correct.
Okay. That's fun.
So they went off on that journey, and eventually it came down to, you know, two places, one in Hungary, one in the Czech Republic. And a Czech producer was able to secure them, you know, one of the studio facilities in the Czech Republic, and we have our train. And I like that because, you know, most of the, obviously it's all in a train, and so you can mm-hmm. redress it, but for the most part, you want to have the four because they're always kind of looking down, you know, whenever they're shooting, you can see it to the past, mm-hmm. the present, and the future. And that's what, you know, each of those can represent. Yes. That's what those can represent. And so I love that aspect of it.
I agree. I think that just for also giving them the freedom to move, because you're already so contained in this idea that you're in one train car and that you're in this world that's trapped on a train. Like, there's so much confinement, which is what brings everything to a boil and allows the stakes to be so high. But to also give the actors that space, I think that it improves just how they can shoot it dramatically. Yeah, just so I thought it was a really good decision and something that I was glad he fought for and didn't just be like, okay, we're going to do each of these studios is a different train.
One of the things
about, like, keeps everyone kind of in the same movement, in the same mindset, and they can just go.
How big do you think each train was? I couldn't get the exact number in terms of any measurement, whether feet, yards, meters.
I couldn't figure it out either. For a really long time, I was just trying to figure out how long the actual train itself was supposed to be. Like, how many cars were supposed to be there? Like,
there's reports, most of the reports that summarize the movie or talk about the movie, they talk about 100.
100 cars.
Yeah. And as you know, as Gilliam and Curtis were talking, you know, he has that line of, like, it doesn't matter whether, you know, you get past 20 to 30 cars, it doesn't matter unless you get to the end. So at least by that notion, let's say, you know, we can safely say maybe 50.
Okay. I don't know, because that was something that kind of I found myself being pulled out and being like, I'm guessing, you presume that you're skipping a lot of cars. You don't get to see the inside of every car because it just doesn't make, that wouldn't make sense. But I was like, how long is this train? What is going on? What is the different sections? And that's fun that you can kind of expand on that in your imagination.
Which, by the way, ends up being a lot of drugs that they're giving away. No, it's two per car.
Yes, that is a lot of drugs.
One to the daughter, one to the father.
Yeah. But they get their fair share in the, you know, the chrono cart later. And it's all good.
So ultimately it's, you know, he collects, that's a lot of explosive he's collected just on this journey, you know, let alone his.
Well, but is it every car or it's just every gate? Maybe they didn't get it. Like, maybe every car doesn't have a gate.
I don't know the train structure. I'm not Wilford, who's been around this since a young age. Although I did play with trains. Which is kind of, you know, as a guy, it's kind of, you know, cool fantasy just in that, you know, you're always playing with trains, so I appreciated that.
No. See, maybe that's why I was pulled out. I was like, why would anyone want a train that goes around the world?
Because you just do. As a male, you just do. You have train sets.
He has this prophetic knowledge of the fact that the world's going to be iced over and they're going to need his train.
I mean, go ahead, Steven.
I wanted to question you guys too, because I got the mm-hmm. feeling that Wilford knew that the world was going to ice over and built this train because of that. Do you think Wilford had any, like, play in creating what they sent in the atmosphere to solve global warming. Because it kind of seems like that was the plan, in a way, for him to become this deity.
I wondered about that, too. And for me, my original thought was it was supposed to be something like that. It was something, because there's so much thematically about control in this movie, and like who has control and who wants control, and how everyone wants to be Wilford. So I was like, Wilford just wanted to, as you said, like me, this, you know, the leader of everything, the creator, the one they all praise, who knows. So I thought maybe he did, because or else why would you put all this effort into building this train unless you already knew? And they even kind of mention his like ability to know what the gas would do. He knew that it was going to freeze over. But then when I researched it more and found out that most of the climate bit was added later, just for the movie, not from the graphic novel, it kind of seemed to me that they merged the two plots and they don't exactly link up. Like, that's why there's no clear explanation, because you're putting two things together that weren't originally part of each other. Like, the whole global warming being put by this gas, and then all of a sudden you're in a new ice age because the earth reacts to you, and whatever, all we try to do doesn't really help humanity. That's the point I was getting. But so I think that you kind of have to make those links for yourself, because they're not really there.
Well, I think it's also an interesting point too, though. If they don't give us everything, it leaves the audience to kind of imagine it, because I mean, when you put everyone on this train, they're kind of in the same boat where they don't really know what's going on. They have an askew history of everything. And most people on this train were don't even remember their time before being not on the train.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see, like, what they imagine into it.
I agree. Like, especially when you do get the train babies versus people who, like Chris Evans' character, I believe he spent half his life on the train
years.
And half off, but he like refuses to remember his childhood. I'm like, 17 years is a long time. Like, you don't remember between when you're born and when you're 17. Come on now.
But I mean, not to cut too far forward to the end, but even the kids at the end, though, they didn't really remember who he was when one was walking towards the engine at the end.
True.
So I mean, I think they just to deal with the situation, their mind.
I think it's also post-traumatic. And you know what I mean? Where, I mean, he's killed kids, he's eaten, you know, he's talked about eating human flesh and understanding that taste, so he's kind of forgotten
and
the rest
so
of
many
it.
People have forgotten, not even just the people from the back of the train, but when you see different characters move up, like when you have the crazy protein bar chef guy who has obviously kind of lost it a little bit and doesn't really seem to be fully there, or when you have the musician when he comes in dressed back in his tux, and he doesn't seem to fully recognize that these were the people that he'd been with for 17 years in the back. Like, there was no camaraderie, there was no, like, welcoming home, there was no sense of family ties. It's like, once you moved up a little bit, you kind of lost more of yourself.
It was an idea of just functionality over any sort of personality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what it was, and I think, you know, there's a big debate whether this movie is more allegorical towards tyranny or capitalism. I go towards tyranny. Just because, again, capitalism, at least there's some sort of person. This just had, everything was focused on the idea of function. And what I like is, in terms of a train, the only place you can go is forward, right? As the actual train.
Mm-hmm.
But you within the train are not, you can go backwards and forwards, but you're not really technically moving
mm-hmm.
anywhere besides this one space.
Versus how typically we see things in like a hierarchical going up.
Yeah.
This is just linear.
Well, it's not even linear. Because in terms of the track, it's cyclical. There's no destination. The destination is just repeats itself. And if you look at, there's the mathematically, right? Let's say you stir a pot. Mathematicians mm-hmm. would argue that you're doing no work at all because you're beginning and ending at the same spot. So even though let's say butter 300 times over, you've done no work.
So you can only really jump outside the train.
Correct.
Which would mean the only people who did work would be the revolution of the seven versus all the other revolutions.
Yeah. I mean,
until this one, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, all I'm saying is basically there's nothing to look forward to. There's just sameness.
Which is an interesting point of this movie, being that obviously their world festers revolution, and it's like a necessity that these revolutions must like happen. But as you said, nothing's truly happening. And maybe that's why the ending bothers me in a way so much. Because if the whole point of all of this is just that everyone's like, there is no solution to humanity, and no matter what anyone tries, it's going to fail again. Because that's what I'm getting out of it. I understand there's like an Adam and Eve thing at the end. I get that. But it's an Adam and Eve in a hostile world that's covered in snow. And oh yeah, randomly there's a polar bear, which I'm sure we can talk about because it really bothers me.
Well, let's talk about the polar bear. To me, I didn't mind the polar bear, but I just, if you're going to show evidence of life being supported in this, a polar bear is not the best example in this situation.
Thank you. Oh, it drove me insane. First of all, I understand that, like, I was like, maybe it's supposed to be like, oh, right now, climate change, one of our biggest, you know, people who are species that it's hurting is the polar bear. There's all these, like, you know, funds and groups that are like, save the polar bear from global warming. It's like, oh, we actually did save the polar bear. We just killed everyone else.
This isn't Dawn of the Planet of the Apes where there was a...
But
in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, there was an organization, gorillas and apes that helped fund the movie.
There
you guys talked about this.
I don't remember talking about that.
Yeah, well, check out Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, anatomy of a movie.
But anyway. Yeah, but for that, and then on top of that, I was like, really, the polar bear is surviving, and just randomly happens to be exactly where they get off this train.
That I don't mind. But.
And then the polar bear didn't eat them, like, and just kind of waltzed away if there's no food and there's no other real life. I don't know, the polar bear just drove me crazy.
I don't know, I
didn't like it.
I didn't like it either, but at the same time, I get it. I mean, animals are attracted to random sounds. So the train going by, the polar bear would have been curious, walks by, and then it wouldn't have been like, hey, I'm going to go eat these people, because it'd been like, what the hell are those?
Really? I feel like if the world is covered in ice and snow, and like people don't think there's life, there's not going to be a lot of things to eat, and if you see anything that could be food, you're going to eat it.
Yeah, but if the polar bear is alive thus far, it means it's been finding food fine.
Well, yeah, which is a whole nother thing.
Which means that basically I'm saying that the animals in the Arctic are probably kind of untouched. And, you know, this is kind of like a conspiracy theory thing going into it. But if you want to look at it in one way, this is the end of the world and the world restarting with two people in the Antarctic as new Inuits, if you kind of think of it.
Yeah, you could definitely, especially because they do mention the Inuit people like halfway through.
I mean, it's kind of weird to think about with like a little kid and her, but you know.
Yeah, and the whole Adam and Eve and waiting, whatever. It bothered me. I didn't like it. That's the ending to your movie. It pulled me out.
You obviously never read Polar Bear, Polar Bear.
No, I did not. I did not read that. I'm sorry. And I like polar bears. This is nothing against them. I just want to throw that out there, too.
Fair enough.
Did you like the polar bear, though?
I didn't think it was the greatest symbol. You know, shot-wise, it looked good, but then at the same time, I'm like, you're shooting white on white already, so, you know what I mean? I wanted something, because the whole point was, right, that they were talking about when they're going through the kind of gardenery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're talking about, you know, this is what's under the snow. So I would have liked to see something under the snow, you know, like just at the top of the mountain, just, you know, the tiniest of flowers and green, it's vegetation.
Right.
So to show
to
white
me, that
on
shows
white.
Life more than like a giant mass bear that's somehow survived.
What about if they had seen like people? Like if they had seen like Inuits that were sledding.
I think that's too far stretch. You know what I mean? Here's the thing. You need to rebuild an ecosystem. And yeah. So, again, that would have just been too convenient, and it would have been like, oh, great, here's this colony of people that knows how to survive. So, you know, you just have to have the slightest glimmer of hope to be able to do this, but I think it's like, you know, a flower that they can eat and grow and whatever.
Yeah, something that, yeah, that's part of it, is that, to me, I understood that it was supposed to show there's life in this Adam and Eve thing, but you wanted to see something, to me, in my opinion as well, that was going to be sustaining. That showed that they had a chance in a way. And to me, a polar bear does not show that they have a chance. It shows to me that they're going to be eaten and everyone's going to die.
Well, at least they didn't
find... everyone already did die, so I don't think they're going to hold any restraints against killing innocent.
At least they didn't show like Jake Gyllenhaal in the library and like cross over into Day After Tomorrow. Because I did get kind of that feel from it a little bit, the Day After Tomorrow, because, oh, like this huge superstorm just freezes everything and there's only one place where you're safe, so I don't know.
That's true. And I think that people have... I'm waiting for the opposite. Have you guys ever seen, like, a movie where global warming, like, makes everything super, like, hot and boiling and no one can survive? That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah.
We've done this now.
I haven't.
It's happened.
I haven't seen that. While we're on that comparison, you know, again, I think it's original enough, but there's tons of homages. To me, the idea of Finding Wilford is like The Prisoner, where it's a British TV show from the 1968, where he has, you know, everyone's labeled as a number and he has to find number one. You're familiar?
I've heard of it. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Fair enough. Sure. So I think there's that comparison. Certainly The Matrix 2 applies here in the sense of, oh, the architect, you know, instead it's an engineer. So, and there's the function of the one, which is, you know, in this case, Curtis, but he doesn't really know his full function until it's realized.
I mean, it's a story about being tied to religion, can be tied to political systems. And I think that they say what? There's like 9 different storylines in different ways.
Well, they say 2. A man goes on a journey or a stranger comes to town. So in this case, a man goes on a journey.
There you go. It's that simple.
It's that simple.
And they did a good job of it, and it was entertaining, and they shot it well, and put a lot of other stuff in there. Do you want to talk more about comparisons? Do you want to get into characters? What do you want to do, Phil?
What comparisons did you see?
I guess when I was more thinking it, I think in general, yeah, you do get things of dealing with what reality is and apocalyptic stories, and you can relate this to blockbusters like The Hunger Games or like anything like that. It's just competition to like live and to be on top. I get that. For me, what was more interesting to think about was the comparisons to other movies that have this kind of crossover between being an independent film and being a big blockbuster, and films that are starting to kind of bridge that gap. And I think it comes from a lot of A-list Hollywood stars going back and forth between huge budget movies and smaller films. And that's happening a lot right now. Like, you're seeing every film festival just filled with A-listers. There's not a ton of newcomers, like, in some of these movies. And so for me, I know I was reading online, someone like compared it to like Drive, and to me that really clicked. Like, they're totally different movies. I mean, they both have like action, but they both feature these Hollywood like heartthrobs, huge guys, and then it's like this different twist. They're like, okay, we're gonna do something smaller, and like Chris Evans is an action star. I mean, how else do you describe the Avengers? And then he did this, but they're just different sides of him, but both displaying his strengths. This obviously, I think, was probably a tougher acting job for him, and a lot of people are really liking his performance.
He did well, especially towards the end. To me, there's a comparison. Now, I want to talk about what stops this from being a big blockbuster, because, and unfortunately, Dimitri isn't here to talk about the full exhibition side of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But when Harvey Weinstein, and there's some conflicting reports, but the stuff that most places talk about and have as
there's
the same
some drama.
There was drama. He saw the movie in its final form. He wanted to cut out about 20 minutes, people say, towards the end.
And supposedly add bookendings.
To add bookendings and things in that nature. The director did not want to change it. And because of how violent it was and because of some of the Korean in there, he just didn't feel it was a mass market type of movie, and so he instead put it with more of his indie label. Now, in terms of the breakdown of had they gone full theatrical, there's a lot of people who actually argue that had they spent $25 million on marketing, put it to theaters, they could have actually came out with $60 million
mm-hmm.
for this movie. And so they're arguing that Harvey Weinstein and his company left money on the table, where right now a lot of people are anticipating it to make around $13 million.
But I mean,
in
no one can ever know because people speculate all over the place. There's also reports out there who did say if you're putting $25 million into publicity, then the cutback is your people are arguing that you might only make like $18 million, yeah, versus on this one they think you they could make like $13 million. So it is money on the table, that being $5 million. But yeah, this is also as great as I know it's all about the money and the cities, whatever. As great as that all is, this is something different. Like, this has broken records for video on demand. This has broken records in like this is backtracking a little bit, sorry guys. But I applaud the director kind of for sticking to his creative intentions and putting the movie he wants out there, because that is worth a lot. It's worth a lot to stick up for what you did.
Well, remember Wong Kar Wai's movie that came out? And that, I remember that there was like three or four different versions of it. And when the American version got to it, it was, there was like 35 minutes cut out.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one really knew what the hell version they saw and what it was supposed to be. And people didn't know how to judge it. So
yeah.
I don't like that. And then Transformers kind of did the same thing, where in the Chinese version, there's a lot more Chinese scenes.
Yeah.
So I just want one movie for everyone.
Exactly. I agree. And so I like that he did that. Also, we have to keep in mind this came out for us, what, 2 months ago-ish?
Yeah,
versus it came out in Korea, like in 2013, with its cut, and did very, very well. If you have a movie that you love and you put your like heart into and it already did well and someone's like, actually, we want you to change it, I'm like glad he was like, no, I like how it is. People seem to like how it is. I'm keeping it this way.
Yeah. And it's, again, like Drive, it's one of those cult followings. I mean, you know, one of the early indicators why not to put that amount of money into marketing was in France, where, you know, the graphic novel came out of it did about 5.2 million reports, mm-hmm, say, and so that was an indication of like, if it's not doing that well in where it originated from, then perhaps not to, you know, put that all that money behind. But as we know, per screen average through the roof.
Yeah, and let's also talk about the fact that if they did do a wide release right now, what they would be competing against. I mean, you're talking about
Transformers,
you're talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, even like Edge of Tomorrow. I'm not saying that it wouldn't have got a good backing, because it does have like Chris Evans and Tilda Swinton and all these people in it, and that's great, but I just don't think, like, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes did so well, and I feel like more people would have seen Dawn over this if it was put for the mass market.
And while
versus, like, people sought this film out, like, and it's all been about world mouth. It's all been about this more of like cult following versus.
And here's, I mean, I really like Snowpiercer, but at the same time, to me, it's still, again, there's a lot of comparisons to other movies. You know, even Noah, the, you know, kind of Noah, I can compare it to, okay, which came out recently, but, or at least relatively recently, and it's not fully original. I don't know. There's just something missing from making it like Inception, making it like The Matrix, something that we've never truly seen. And I think that to me is what is ultimately holding it back from a full wide release. It's not, to me, it's honestly the violence and whatever else. You know, I think people ultimately can gravitate towards a smart movie, which I think what Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is.
I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes did very well with a lot of their subject matter.
You know, but I think it's that slight thing that's fully hindering it.
I'm trying to think what hinders this movie for me. I really like the premise.
The polar bear.
That, I mean, besides the polar bear, which I don't mean to harp on, although I totally am, so sorry. I like the world. I like how Steven mentioned that you get to really dive in and you get to kind of be contained with them. I really like that. What's holding it back for me is I'm coming out of this movie, who I attached to, the characters I attached to, were a lot of the supporting, which is great. Like, they had really good supporting actors. But I came out of this with my favorite moments coming from a lot of people who died, like Tilda Swinton. Like,
well, how about this? You know, let's talk about the actors, but, you know, that's an interesting point because – one of the things that at least for American audiences throws it off is that, and why I think, you know, we're talking about the ending so heavily is because Curtis, you know, his whole journey is this him becoming a hero, him becoming a leader. And, you know, it's great that he sacrifices himself, but ultimately we're positioned and used to.
We've been conditioned to have our hero survive and be able to actually lead.
Yeah. And that, like, I don't think it's the fact that two people came out of it alive. It's that Curtis isn't the one that came out of it alive.
But he goes through this journey and he... And the way the sacrifice is an acceptance, and it is a parallel to the fact that he couldn't sacrifice in the beginning, and then he has a small sacrifice of his arm, and then, not the, a smaller sacrifice of his arm, and then he can make the great sacrifice of his life. But he does it in kind of, to me, like a, well, I don't really like this, and I don't really want to live as much or be here. I don't know.
But ultimately, he didn't make the choice of what was going to happen next. He didn't, you know what I mean? It, had he said, like, hey, I'm going to sacrifice not only my arm, but my life, so that way you can open that door and put the explosive there and be out in the world.
Versus just this reactionary?
Yeah, he wasn't. He never made that choice to do something.
That's true.
And I think. You know, I think that's where the weakness lies. For an American audience, mm-hmm. for a foreign audience, I think they're very used to that type of thing. It's just a different way of telling stories.
I agree. It's just it's true. We expect the people for us most to connect to or have emotions towards are going to be your Curtis character, your Wilford character, maybe your Gilliam or. Those, but where I was connecting was to Nam, to Yona, to what was her name in the movie? It's played by Octavia Spencer. Tanya?
Yeah, I just always refer to her as Octavia Spencer.
Yeah, I do too. But like those were the people.
Or the woman looking for a child.
Those were the people I was like rooting for. That's who my heart was with. And like, that's like, as much as I enjoyed watching Chris, I wasn't standing alongside him. I was standing alongside, like, Octavia, like, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those were the people who I was rallying to get out.
I want to, for one of the things that kind of killed the movie for me, in just one of the things I did not like about the movie,
mm-hmm.
is that it was so easy for the characters we know to die. But then when they fight that one guy, like, he just will not die. And it's like...
The cyborg?
Yeah, it got unrealistic to the point where I was watching it with a friend and we were just laughing. Because we're just like, this is so dumb that he's not dead.
And what was his motivation? Why was he so centered on killing Yona?
Yeah, we don't even know, like, what his connection to Wilford was, aside from just being big badass bodyguard dude. I guess he was, like, the head of the people who... The black hooded people. But it's still... I think but that character single-handedly brought the movie down one or two ratings.
He was so zeroed in on Yona. I understand being zeroed in on Curtis because he, you know, is leading a revolution. But, like, Yona is just, like, to any passerby, a girl. And maybe he understood that she had this, like, clairvoyance about her. But there was no articulation of that. There was just like, I'm going to kill you because I'm center focused on you. Like, maybe it's because they knew, because she was already that's why they had put her in prison. I'm not really sure.
I think because Wilford knew, I think it was his order to him to do that. And I think just like with the scene in the cart with the children, they're just conditioned to be pawns. And there's as he's walking through and they're all dancing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're enjoying it, right? And they talk about like, at first when, you know, they take the guy away because he's, you know, a Boston Orchestra Symphony violinist,
mm-hmm.
you know, you imagine that they're enjoying this, right? Mm-hmm. That yes, they, you know, they don't really care about the misery of the tail end of the train, but they're enjoying the music. They're not. It's just something to do.
That's what they do. Yeah, I agree.
And so this guy's just been so conditioned and he understands the functionality of this. And I think, ironically, right, as you know, Curtis is not the anomaly, right? Let's use the Matrix references. Curtis is, you know, he's doing his function. He's supposed to get to the front of the train.
No, he's not supposed to get to the front, is he? Did you get that he was supposed to? I felt like it was a change in decision that one time, after he made it back a certain point, then he was like, okay, now your function has to become to the front. I don't think from the very beginning, Wilfred was like, this guy's going to make it all the way.
But they said that they've been talking a while and that Gillian, they've mm-hmm. been phoning each other.
Of course.
The movie presented it like his purpose, right? Everyone has that function. His purpose was to get to the front of the train.
Okay.
His birth destiny, I don't know, but eventually as him on the train.
Interesting. I took it kind of as his destiny was to lead a revolution and to get to a certain point, and then he passed that point, in which case Wilfred was like, this guy can't make it to the front. And I think there was a turning point where, I guess in my opinion, I read it as Gilliam was part of this plan, but it was not part of his plan for Gilliam to originally die. And the plan kind of altered by how far Curtis was able to go.
But I think
I'm not sure if I'm right. That's just how I felt.
I get that. Gillian, to me, I think he was smarter than he let on. And I think he knew that this whole thing, in order to keep the balance, he needed to die. I think at what point he knew this was going to happen or not, I don't know. But he knew that that was going to be his ultimate end.
That makes sense. I want to go back a little to when you mentioned the teachers, the classroom scene.
That was my favorite section.
What I will very much applaud this movie for is taking risks. There is so many scenes that were, you could totally push off as over the top, and they, to me, made them work. And they just went over and beyond, specifically in the school scene, how they have the musical number, how they have the full eye twitch with the, as she spins around the piano and she's singing and her eye is twitching. That is so over the top. And then to have the pregnant lady with the gun and the New Year eggs, everything was just pushed. And that continued and came up and popped throughout the movie, even in the beginning when, Wilfred's right hand lady gets hit in the head with a shoe and she licks the blood. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that are they just kept pushing, and for me it worked.
Yeah.
For me, and it was changed, and it changed genres. For a split second in the teacher scene, it became a musical. And I was like, okay,
and
fine.
Tilda's dancing as well.
Exactly.
Despite being a prisoner, she's so excited about what's going mm-hmm. on.
Or how they had.
I mean, they say it. They say the rebellions make people more content because there's something that's going on. It's entertainment for the train in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
People like crazy news.
Again, it's that weirdness that you just need something to do.
But it was always much I think his name was Gray. The guy who's a super good fighter who would just come out sporadically and pull off crazy ninja moves. That was so entertaining. And, I don't think he had, hardly any lines, if any. He maybe had two. And I loved his character because they just, had him be, just absolutely, this incredible ninja. And I was and now we're in a kung fu movie. It was just great. I loved all of that. I loved the little splashes of, color that they just kind of threw in.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly, they used a huge scope. Again, you would think that because it's a train, things would kind of be the same, but, and I want to ask you guys what your favorite section was, but the tail end is very bleak. Mm-hmm. When we have the dancing scene, it's very purple. The kids, it's very yellow. We have that in full darkness, so we're, we have night vision, and that was really
everything.
Cool.
They just threw and they're let's use this now.
So I really enjoyed it, but let's start with you, Sarah. What was your favorite portion of the movie?
I'm not really sure what my favorite, I thought different. It's hard to compare them because each section was so different color-wise, scope-wise. The sauna room had that whole, the mist, or aquarium, which felt like, it literally felt like I was in one of those, and museum, and it felt so real to me. But they were all so different, and I really liked that. And I think each scene very much portrayed the mood of that, up to the, even the engine, how it was just that, the openness of being in that engine, everything completely being able to be tucked away and hidden throughout the entire room, versus where you have the back of the train, everything's in your face and everyone's personal lives are shoved at you and you can't get away from like anything. It's just crowded and people living on top of each other, and just how they made these differences from place to place, and everything was, you needed one frame, it's just like one picture for them to set up the entire setting of that section. Mm-hmm. Like even the, like the drug den, how it was like in these like pits and the fur coats, and it was like you could almost like smell it. It was just so that I don't know if I could find an exact specific moment that I really liked. I really enjoyed when they were just like barging through and doing that first breakdown of like all the gates, and then you had everyone running on top of the chained like barrels, and those moments were all great to me. So
Steven, what about you? What was your favorite portion of the train?
Well, they could have taken this movie in so many different ways, and I'm going to reference something, make a comparison here in a second, but my favorite part of the train was when they open the door and all the guys are standing there with hatchets and the black masks and everything.
Did you like the fish?
I like the fish, and I like the allegory of, like, you know, like, we have to control the population because we can only have sushi one time a year. That's kind of speaking to the people who are overfishing the bluefin tuna right now.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene, like, the way it was shot and the way it's opened up to you, it's terrifying. And yeah. It reminded me of, like, a Silent Hill game where you just go into a room, or maybe Dark Souls where you go into a room and you're just, like, you see something and you just want to run the hell out of there and just crawl in a corner and cry. That was ridiculous.
That was also a really good scene to me, because how they did mix that really menacing, scary approach with also ritual. Because so many times we just see people who are fighters and, you know, just in a way brutes. And this, the fact that they added that fish to me was, and took that moment before the fight started, it was both added like a menacing element even more, but it also showed that there was like a sense of thought behind it, and that they weren't just pawns, but they had a ritual themselves, which to me was really interesting and made them more scary.
Well, what's interesting about this movie as well is that everyone in each section of the train is stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just the back that's stuck in the back. The middle's stuck in the middle, the front's stuck in the front.
Mm-hmm.
They all have their own set way of life, and they've been in it for 17 years. They're all trapped in their own special little hell, just maybe some are more comfortable than others. In this scene, it's kind of interesting to see that all these people, like, their one purpose is to basically just be this kill squad on the train in case of these rebellions. And you know what I actually really liked about this scene as well is that they didn't just run at them and start hacking away. Like, they had that scene where they're like kind of testing it, like, who's going to go first?
Because
mm-hmm. all the movies, like, where you see two groups of people running into each other, they always just run without any hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of was a more humanistic look at, like, people are kind of like,
who's going to go first?
I mean, we have the hatches, but, like,
the waters.
Still going to die. Like, yeah. I mean, I think they were just, it's just an exciting time. But I did want to, I want to compare this movie real quick. And I know you guys are going to be totally lost on this, but BioShock.
I am not lost on BioShock.
Okay.
Ha! I'm really bad at it, but I have played it.
Okay.
So I win.
So BioShock.
Just putting it out there.
BioShock is a game that is basically.
Really cool.
It's based upon Atlas Shrugged in some respects. It's a utopia built under the sea in like the 40s or 50s where people can run rampant with their science or whatever, in the everything's in the name of science. But everyone's trapped under the sea as all these things are being made, and it's all these high-class people, and there is this class separation, just like in this train. And the surprising thing is the difference in the train is that somehow things have been kept in order, which in BioShock, everything goes to hell because of people's own want to get higher on the totem pole and things like that. And basically, people just start killing each other and everything is a massacre, which I'm surprised the movie did not take that turn where they get to the front of the train. And I thought it would be just as bad as the back of the train.
Well, what I thought was interesting, instead of that route, at least what they did give you was besides the back of the train, who obviously was so unfulfilled, they're like, they had to have this revolution, is that people did react. People started coming after them once their life had been interrupted. Like, once their drugs got stolen, once their party was kind of crashed, they started reaction and they started following. And it was like, once someone could move past them or could interrupt them.
It's a ripple.
Exactly. And it's just, ripple started from the back, which was interesting. But everyone was so messed up that how did they even understand what was going on?
It's kind of like
drugged out and drunk.
The train is kind of like a good metaphor for like burning a wick. Like you're setting off the dynamite, you're burning the wick, and it starts from the tip and then moves all the way to the front, and then the train kind of explodes.
And then it explodes.
Woohoo!
Yippee!
Fair enough.
I wanted to throw something out there, but now I'm forgetting what it was. Stephen, you made me think of it, and now I'm going to be lost. So let's talk about something else, because I have to find what I was thinking.
Speaking of movie comparisons, I did want to compare this to The Giver, and ironically enough, it is being released under the same banner. The Giver.
What do you mean? It's released under the same banner?
Radius is releasing Radius The Giver.
The Giver makes me nervous. It's one of my favorite books. It's really...
It will certainly be interesting. What else was I going to say? Oh, you know, going back to kind of distribution, you know, one of the things that I did want to mention was the success of it, right? Very rarely are movie theaters cooperative to do kind of a release that soon on mm-hmm. video on demand. So the fact that, you know, you're one of eight theaters in the country that kind of agreed to it where, you know, 2 weeks after this comes out, in theaters, it's released mm-hmm. on video on demand, yep. which is usually there's a 90-day window.
And they're breaking all the rules.
They did.
And doing well.
Doing well. It's not quite like Veronica Mars, because that was literally the same day. But the notion was that, okay, give people just enough of a taste, get the word of mouth going. And for the most part, this movie's surviving. It had a $5 million budget in terms of marketing, but it's really surviving on that word of mouth.
Is that how you heard about it? How'd you hear about this movie?
You.
I saw it on Rotten Tomatoes.
What? You saw it on Rotten Tomatoes?
I saw it on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm like, that looks interesting. And then I asked you guys, and you were like, yeah, it's at my theater.
Gotcha. Yay! Thanks to me, these folks have seen it. I'm taking credit. Do you guys want to know some fun facts?
Go ahead.
About this film. First of all, this one I got from someone else online. They pointed it out, and I was like, that is so true. So I'm going to call them out on the fact that they make a very clear point to say that Curtis is the only person who's ever gone from the back of the train to the front. This is not true. There are multiple other people who have done this. First of all, his right-hand crazy lady, who... I really liked her. She was nuts, and I really enjoyed watching
her
being nuts.
They costumed her well. She was so easily identifiable.
In the yellow and everything, and her hair. Yes. But she was just like, gave zero fucks, sorry. But she just like was just like, nope, this is my role.
She reminded me of Pam from Archer.
I could see it. But so she has crossed the entire train. True, she went from front to back to front, but she still has crossed it. Number two, all the little kids they've taken over time. They've all done the exact same path.
Yeah, but they don't remember.
It doesn't matter. They did it.
Okay.
I'm just pointing that out. I just want it to be known that he was not the first, and that really we need to say, good job, kids. On this... Second point I wanted to point out is that one of the things that I really liked in this movie was how they had the artists in the back of the train who did all the pictures. And I looked it up, and the person who did those was the actual creator of Les Transperneige. I can't pronounce that. I'm sorry. I'm not French. The French graphic novel. And so I liked that they brought him in to do those, and they were very cool and very well done. And I thought were a nice little point for the movie, because I think to me that was a really real thing that they did find ways to connect and to make a home and to have something that did provide them with remembering what they're going through, because so many people forget in this, and that they had these things to hold on to, and that it was happening in the back of the train. They were the ones who were remembering and knowing. And I thought that visually they added a lot. So I just want to throw this little out there.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, what else you guys want to talk about? For me, I've talked all I have to necessarily say about
this. We should mention, I need to re-listen to the soundtrack again, because I think what you come out of this with is so many images. I think back to this movie and it's just like shot after shot, like flashes through my mind, and there's so much variety in it. From,
well, there's getting fast, what I like is there's fast movement, and then it takes its time, especially in, let's talk, you know, the sauna scene. Mm-hmm. It's just so creepy because it's, I don't remember if there's music, but it's very quiet. Mm-hmm. And then he looks at the woman and she's like, "What are you doing here?"
and he still moves her aside.
Yeah,
there's so many. And like the end shots of, as like the fire is like burning in the background, and everyone's like cloaked in this like red and to the grays. And I just thought that visually you come out of this so impacted, and like with so many, for me, it's just like still shots in my mind, and they're breathtakingly visual. To me, this sounds like such a silly comparison, but it's how I actually can't even make it because I'll get made fun of. Never mind.
Fair enough.
So have we even really dove into the plot, really, or were you thinking of wrapping this up? Because, I mean, we haven't mentioned about how he tells the story of when he was 17, he almost cut his arm off to feed people because everyone in the back of the train was feeding each other, and how that ties back into at the end as well, when
he gives up his arm.
When he gives up his arm for the little kids.
Well, he gives up his arm.
And how the motion is the same motion that the Mason uses in all of her speeches.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
If you notice, Tilda Swinton, which is kind of an interesting point, that as she like describes everyone's function in the very beginning of the movie, when she's talking about the shoe on the head and all that stuff.
Which comes back later when the guy makes her walk around with a shoe on her head.
There's a lot, yeah. But she does, with her hand multiple times, she does like the reach forward, the twist, the pull back, or whatever the exact moment is with her arm. And that is the exact same movement that the children are using to reach in and replace the part.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even notice that. And then there's the guy at the beginning where they put his arm outside the train mm-hmm. to burn it off. I mean, the arm just is a very signaled thing yes. in this movie. And then I didn't want to just say, like, as somebody who watched the movie without any subtitles, it was interesting to see how the acting comes off. And I kind of am glad that I watched it without subtitles, because it makes you think more. It makes you try to understand, and you're in the same kind of position that Chris Evans is in the movie, not knowing the language, trying to understand what he's saying
mm-hmm.
and kind of making the body language explain it to you. So I really kind of enjoyed it from that standpoint. So I do recommend you watch it without the subtitles if you do get a chance and want to, because, I mean, I still kind of understood the whole story, and it was like not shoved down my throat. It was more of like a thing of discovery as opposed to a thing of, this is what's going on.
Well, that's, and just with my conversation, I mean, Steven, you and I talked a little bit about this before, and I think that Steven did get like most of this entire movie without subtitles. The one thing I'll point out to you, if there's anyone listening or watching who did not see the subtitle version, one key point to me is that the reason they're looking out the window is because he sees a plane under the bridge, and he's been watching it for years, and originally he can only see part of, like, I believe the tail fin, and then as the years go by, he started to see more and more, and this year he has seen the wings, which leads them to believe that it's getting warmer and that it can sustain life, because that's all done through his dialogue. So if you didn't see the subtitle version, that's what that means. I just thought that, because they should know.
Fair enough. What else? I mean, we've kind of briefly touched on the editing, but again, the pacing overall was very good. In terms of the notion to cut out 20 minutes, I keep reading that it was the last 20 minutes that were, you know, not necessarily the exact 20 minutes, but a chunk of it. What do you think could have been taken away? And would I know we are applauding the director for sticking mm-hmm. to his vision, but could this theoretically movie have worked without?
I mean, I think that goes back to the point that I made about, as Ed Harris, great actor. I understand having the overpowering, like, Wilford figure, the name is strong enough. The scene they had at the end didn't really do too much for me. Like, I didn't come out of this being like, oh, when a great conversation between Curtis and Wilford, like, that was a great scene. I was more of like, oh, I really want to see this movie again, more for Nam and Yona. Like, they were so interesting.
But I think functionally needed. I mean, what I applaud this movie for, it just threw you right into it. You don't know the rules, and you're kind of finding out as you go along, and things are revealed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Exposition as ammunition rather than like, hey, years ago, that you get kind of what you need, and then you're figuring it out.
Yeah, I think that but I'm pointing out that if there's anything that stuck out to me as like, huh, this is weird, it's going to be what Steven mentioned earlier with the like guy who just could not die coming back and being a constant focus. And number two is the actual conversations between Wilford and Curtis, where I was kind of like, okay.
Yeah. And I think part of why you didn't really need that one guy in particular was he served his purpose. And you could have had the revolt started by the people rather than just, you know, the bodyguard. And I think that could have been even more effective, certainly enough effective.
What was your guys' reaction to when they stop during the fight train and they're counting down to one? Like, what did you think was going to happen? What was your reaction to that scene?
Are you talking about when it got dark?
Happy New Year.
Oh, with the eggs and them all counting and the guns being brought out. That scene was...
No. I'm talking about when they're all fighting the guys with hatchets and things like that, and suddenly everyone stops and the dude with the whistle counts down and they stop fighting for a second to say, oh, Happy New Year, as they pass this one point in the train. Like,
I thought it was interesting. It made sense to me that they like were willing to, the guys with the hatchets were willing to stop fighting, like, to celebrate, because, I don't know, it's one of the only rituals. Like, they establish that people are so conditioned in this that they have songs they sing. They have stories they've heard 100 times. And, like, part of them which keeps them happy is this repetition, is this element of control that they have in their lives. And I think that their celebration of the new year reflects that. And then I thought it was more weird that people from the back of the train who didn't have those experiences or connections didn't keep fighting, but I'm just like chalking that up to them being like kind of shocked.
It's also interesting. I don't know how it works in other cultures per se, but a new year is supposed to signal a new beginning, right? People have new year's resolutions, and especially in that moment, if they're just kind of stopping to appreciate this one moment, but then returning right into it, there's nothing new about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more of the same.
It's more of the cycle, Steven, according to Phil.
That's right. So,
you know what he's going to say.
Steven's dead in the booth. He got killed.
I'm here.
He's right there. See?
What else? What else, Steven? You said you had a lot of plot points that you wanted to talk about.
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm like...
Thank you, Steven.
I don't know. Oh, I do want to mention, though, I was reading this article, and it's like, how an obscure second century Christian heresy influenced Snowpiercer. It goes into all these symbolisms about this, you know, about how, like, Chris Evans, like, at the very end has the bullet hole through his hand as he's making his monologue, which is very, like...
Christ-like,
crucifixion-like. And they kind of talk about how then Wilford could kind of be, like... the devil who, like, offers Jesus to replace him and stuff like that. And there's a lot of spiritual connections all throughout, which I thought was very fascinating to read. I just want to point that out.
Well, we'll post that as part of the articles in the helpful section. Anyway, I think that about does it for us for this dissection. Thank you guys for listening. Let us know your thoughts on Snowpiercer. A lot to talk about. I'm sure there's tons that we didn't talk about, whether
there
it's a religious
aspect.
There's
so much, yeah, underneath this symbolism, meaning tell us what you caught, what little tidbits you found, or how you related. That's interesting.
And, you know, we like that. We like continuing the discussion. What we really enjoy is that at any point people can find these movies, and we get comments from movies way back when. You know, we also get recent movies, so it's always great that the dialogue can continue in perpetuity. It's like the perpetual motion machine. It's just always going. Thank you guys for listening. Spread the word of Anatomy of a Movie. Thank you, Stephen Lemieux. Where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Stephen Lemieux. Yep.
And
hi, I'm here.
Sarah Strand does not have social media. She's very, but you can check out some of her movies that will be coming out soon. She's doing a lot.
Or you can just find me here. Hi.
At Anatomy of a Movie. And hey, you know what? The girl likes Archer, she likes BioShock, and she likes Snowpiercer.
I don't Great really catch. Like Archer, sorry.
Well, you understood the reference. Anyway, follow us here on Movie Anatomy on Twitter, anatomyofamovie.com. We've got a lot of dissections coming up for you. Begin Again. Then next week, we have Lucy, we have Boyhood, and some other movie.
Hercules!
No, I don't think we're... Not for a little bit. So much to talk about, so many past dissections, so many future dissections. We'll see you right here.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.